Good morning, everyone. We have a couple of items on our agenda. I want to deal with a couple of administrative items first. First is to, if there are no objections, I would like to have the agenda approved. Are there any objections to the agenda? Okay. Seeing none, approved. Okay, very good. Absolutely. And then the next thing I would like to do is to approve our minutes from the October 11th meeting. Do I have a motion to Okay, good. And then, alrighty. So we have a motion, have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, very good. So we can move on there. We're very delighted to have Ms. Mason present today updates on the safety program. I'll mention that Mr. Dorsey and myself were out with Ms. Mason and the team at National Airport. As I mentioned, transit is something new to me, but I'm familiar with large-scale construction. I was responsible for the patent and trademarks complex down in Alexandria, so I'm comfortable around large construction. A couple of observations. One, the organization and the focus of the teams. The teams were engaged. They were working. Things were done orderly. I was also impressed with the amount of work that needs to be done. So, you know, it's great to come sit in the briefings, but you get a different perspective when you're actually out there and you see and people show you things. So thank you very much for that. What we're going to do is ask Ms. Mason to talk to us a little bit about the preventive maintenance program. Where are we today? Rather than have a vote on the preventive maintenance at this time, we'd like to task management with a couple of items, and we'll cover that. But before I move on to the second item, I just want to underscore the importance that the committee sees in safety. When you look at what are some of the core responsibilities of the board and of WMATA, it's real simple. It's got to be safe. Got to have a safe, reliable system. That's incredibly important to us. The second thing that we're looking forward to is an update on the Capitol rebuilding project next summer and what will happen on the blue and yellow lines in Northern Virginia and the steps that we're taking to make that as an effective rebuilding program as possible. So I will come back to our taskings after you complete the first of the presentations. But again, welcome and thank you very much for taking good care of us a couple of weeks ago.
And you are absolutely welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on site, and I invite any of the other board members, if you'd wish, we'd be more than happy to take you out and show you the work that we're doing on the tracks. So good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to present to you the status of the preventive maintenance program and the effect it has had on the rail service. The purpose this morning was to provide a comprehensive report on the progress and results of the preventive maintenance program in accordance with Resolution 2016-52, and we were seeking board approval to continue the PM programs and capital work under current hours, but I understand we will defer that vote. Before we get into the details of the program, I would like to provide some context for the discussion about how maintenance hours and the work conducted affect customer on-time performance, because safe, reliable rail service requires sufficient time for maintenance and capital renewal. Note, in the numbers I will provide you today, customer on-time performance is for all customers at all hours, including when we have scheduled track work. Before SafeTrack, so fiscal years 1998 to 2016, we had a period of expanding service and reducing maintenance time. Over that period, from 1998 to 2016, we doubled the service provided when we consider the vehicle miles traveled. However, during the time, we also cut our work hours by 25%, down to 33 hours per week of non-passenger service. This combination led to deteriorating rail service, including a record low customer on-time performance of just 68.9% in May 2016, before we launched the SafeTrack program. If you take the 15-month average customer OTP in that period, we were 79% on time and losing 1% per month. SafeTrack was conducted during fiscal 17 and was really an emergency renewal period. We did our 24/7 safety surges and we increased our overnight window to 39 hours per week, and that time was available to all crews who needed to work on our right of way. Post-SafeTrack, so starting in fiscal 2018, we have been investing in our infrastructure, investing in capital renewal and preventive maintenance. We also increased our overnight work window to 41 hours per week, and that has had the net effect of improving our rail service. We have a record high customer on-time performance of 89.9% achieved in September 2018. And more importantly, if you look at the 15-month average, so what customers recognize as consistent, reliable service, we've averaged 88% on target and gaining slightly every month at 0.1%.
So you were saying if we were to reduce the amount of hours, we would expect to see those trends go in the opposite direction?
Correct. We can maintain the stable service because we are spending the time overnight to do the necessary maintenance to proactively identify and address track issues rather than allowing them to affect passenger service. Okay. And this OTP that we had is our best since 2011, when we could first start calculating it. So a little more detail on the history of the current preventive maintenance programs we're going to discuss in this session today. These specific programs have their origins in June 2016, when we realized the need to shift from reactive to proactive maintenance. Over that time in 2016, as we were starting the SafeTrack program, we studied our incident history and came to the board in December of 2016 with a proposal for a comprehensive preventive maintenance program and obtained your approval to change our service hours to support it. In July 2017, those hours went into effect, and our last update to you was in May 2018. The chart on the right shows a moving six-month average of our customer on-time performance. And it shows what our customers experience, what is our consistent service. And as you can see, in FY16, we had a continual decline every month, losing 1%. And that continued through the first half of fiscal 17. But even halfway through the SafeTrack program, we could start to see the benefits of our investments paying off as OTP hit its bottom and started rising again, and it has been stable through FY18. So this is a good news story. It shows the impact of the service change, though we still have more work to do to continue on this path to deliver reliable service to our customers. So the improvement in rail service is a direct result of having shifted our focus from being reactive to proactive. It is truly cause and effect that doing preventive maintenance and capital renewal work proactively will improve safety and reliability. Comparing first quarter of FY16 with the first quarter of FY19, we've more than doubled our work wrench hours, so work executed in the overnight window. This increase in our investment in our infrastructure has led to a decline in unplanned work. Comparing first quarter of FY19 with FY17, track incidents are down 86%, and our emergency work our crews say needs to be done within the next 72 hours, is down 76%. And as I've said, this led to our approved service. September 2018 was our best ever customer on-time performance at 90%, and our rail customer satisfaction is rising. When we measured at the end of FY16, we were at 66% of our customers were satisfied. At the end of FY18, that had risen to 79%. let's dive into a bit of the detail of these 6 p.m. programs. I like to treat them or describe them in two buckets. One, the first is electrical fires. These are wayside electrical fires. And we selected these programs because these are the highest severity incidents. These are safety issues that we need to proactively identify and address before they become a smoke or fire incident. The second bucket is our track defects. These are our highest frequency issues. So these are the ones that contribute to deteriorating reliability and a frustration with our service, as well as safety issues. Within the electrical fires, this is arguably the most important and most challenging of our PM programs. They take the most time to execute on a given night, and also the longest time to pass to complete a full pass of the system. For these programs, we are still less than a third complete of our system. So track bed cleaning is a program in which we are trying to clean our track beds to remove all debris, water, and other contributing factors to smoke and fire incidents. When we started this program, we committed to cleaning the red line underground portions on an annual basis. Starting in FY19, we expanded the program to include all underground sections of track. And as of the end of September, we were 37% complete with the first pass through the system. Cable measuring, this is truly a safety-related program because this is testing our electrical cables, our high-voltage electrical cables, to ensure they have sufficient insulation so they will not break down and cause a serious fire incident within our tunnels. This is a four-year program, and we are approximately 30% of the way through the system. But importantly, what we have found doing this program is that our negative returns, those heavy-duty cables that take the electrical current from the train back to the substation, have been experiencing a 22% failure rate. So it's very important that we continue this program and proactively identify and replace these cables. Stray current testing is another test that we do to verify the electrical isolation of the track. These are the programs that would help us identify fasteners and stud bolts that are likely to create an arcing incident. And it is a five-year program to get through the whole system. And so far, our pass rate in terms of sections we have tested is about 20%. So this is a program that's identifying capital renewal work we need to do and helping us prioritize our fastener replacement program. Within the track defects, these programs are further progressed, and we have been evolving them as we learn more about their impacts and finding more efficient ways to approach the work. With torquing, as of the end of September, we were at 82%, and we have shifted our approach here to one that is more about a thorough inspection and testing of the bolts prior to proactively torquing them down, as we found that would be a way to better maintain our infrastructure. Tamping is about our ballasted track and ensuring that we have good horizontal and vertical alignment. The tracks are exactly where they should be and that the ballast, the rock supporting them, is well compacted and firm so we can transfer the load safely to the ground. That is a two-year program, and we are 43% complete as of the end of September and almost halfway through now. Our switch maintenance program, this is a really important one because this falls in between that frequency and severity when we look at our risk mitigation strategies. We have a number of interlockings, and what we do is every quarter we go out and inspect them, prioritize them for replacement, for repairs. Initially, when we started this at the beginning of FY18, we thought this would be a five-year program. By changing our approach and changing our resource allocation, we've reduced that to 3 years.
Good.
And as of the end of September, 62% of our interlockings were considered in good condition. So what is the result or the impact of these programs? I spoke earlier about measuring overall rail performance by customer on-time performance, but to measure the effectiveness of these programs themselves, we actually monitor the incidents related to those assets and those types of failures. We define an incident as an infrastructure defect that affects passenger service. So, for example, a track defect might be loose fasteners that cause us to implement a speed restriction or have to suspend service over a section of track.
But it also could have a safety.
Correct. Thank you. Yeah. When we find these incidents, they impact passenger service because we have determined that it is an unsafe condition and we cannot continue to operate trains as normal, as we would normally do.
Okay.
So that means those loose fasteners are presenting a condition where we are concerned there's a derailment risk or a serious safety issue, and so we slow the trains down or we stop them running over that section of track. Looking looking at our overall track infrastructure incidents, we've already exceeded the goal we set for ourselves of cutting infrastructure-related delays in half. We said we would do that in 2 years, and we actually achieved that by the end of FY18. But there's still more work to do, because we would like to see none of these incidents. However, challenges remain on the wayside electrical fires. When we drill down into this subsection of incidents, we have seen a positive trend that we've reduced our wayside electrical fires by 20% comparing FY18 to FY17. Right now, we are not on track to achieve that 50% reduction by the end of FY19. These fires can range from being an arcing insulator to debris that is caught around an insulator or a cable fire. What we have seen in the last, in these first 18 months of the PM program is a reduction in the severity of smoke and fire incidents. For example, we have not had a high voltage cable fire since we started this program. But we still have more work to do. A 20% reduction is not enough. So looking back at the big picture, we have made significant progress with this paradigm shift from reactive to proactive work. Back in 2016, we advised the board that we believe that SafeTrack 2.0 is preventable if we had the track time to implement two things: a robust capital program and preventive maintenance programs. That triangle on the left shows you where approximately we spent our hours in a pre-safe track condition. We were doing the bulk of our time on corrective maintenance, we were doing some capital renewal, and relatively little preventive maintenance. And our goal is to end up on the right-hand side with doing a large amount of preventive maintenance, keeping our assets in a good condition, staying current with our capital renewal, and ensuring that we're replacing assets as needed. And if we're doing those two things right, we'll see a reduction in our corrective maintenance. Looking at our capital program, our capital work wrench hours are up over 300% compared to fiscal 16 first quarter with FY19 first quarter. Previously, our capital work was about a quarter of our work wrench hours, and now we're up to about half of our hours. Also, our maintenance of way capital investment, this is our investment into our track and structures, our train control system, and our traction power system, is up 50% comparing the 3 years before SafeTrack to the years since. And all of this is to benefit our customers. So far today, I've focused on our PM programs and our track infrastructure, but I want to note that safe and reliable service requires more than just the tracks to be in a state of good repair. Our current service hours are vital for the advancement of our whole capital program beyond just maintenance of way. As I said, 50% of our work hours executed in the overnight window are capital, and I would like to take a moment to highlight some of those very important projects that would be impacted by any discussion on service hour changes. This includes our radio infrastructure replacement program. This is what enables cellular service and Wi-Fi service within our tunnels. This would be the continuation of our 100% 8-car train power upgrades, a program we started on several years ago, as well as numerous programs related to our tunnel ventilation improvements and our smoke detection and standpipe replacements within our underground system. In conclusion, we won't be recommending board approval, as we will put that off for a month, but we will continue to provide comprehensive progress reports on these PM programs on how we're using our time and the effect that has on rail service. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions you may have.
Okay. Before I get into our taskings, I'd like to give our members an opportunity to ask questions, make comments, first from our members of this particular committee, but then we'll open that up more broadly to other members as well. First off, yes, Mr.
David. Please. No, please.
This is a question.
Yeah.
To the question I'm going to ask at the end.
Sure.
Is it, I mean, to your knowledge, is it the case that the closure by FTA of corrective action plans to date is predicated on continuing the current levels of access by crews to track? In other words, are the caps based in part on a kind of prospective commitment or understanding of track access for performance of preventive maintenance and repairs?
I don't believe it's as prescriptive as that, but there are caps that make request that we do zero-based budget analysis, things for track access, as far as the ability to perform maintenance to do that type of analysis. So that's very close to what you're saying, yes.
Have you received indications from FTA that if the access to track for performance of preventive maintenance or repairs were curtailed, that they would rescind any previously approved corrective action plan?
I don't believe we've received anything of that nature, but you'd really have to direct that question to the FTA.
Is it your understanding that if FTA rescinded any previously approved corrective act or closed corrective action plan, that the rescission would imperil the availability of federal funds for performance of preventive maintenance and repairs?
I think the whole line of question that you have, I think, is where the FTA generally has been, which is if we don't perform, we don't continue to perform, that's what we put at jeopardy. So I think the overall arching line of question, I think you're correct.
Thank you. That I'd like to finish this series of questions by paying management a compliment. I think the turnaround of WMATA will be a case study read by students at the finest schools for government administration in the United States. Well done.
Very nicely done. Mr. Dorsey, you would?
Thank you. A couple questions. Appreciate it. And Ms. Mason, thank you for the great presentation, and to the entire team for all of the great work that's producing results that we can all, I think, be proud of. I'm curious, one, during the course of implementing our first ever PM program, we had our six programs that we thought we needed to implement. Have we uncovered the need for any new programs that might be a part of future ongoing PM work?
Yes, we have. One in particular, it relates to our cable measuring. When we started this program, we were focused on high voltage traction power cables. As we've dug into our wayside electrical fires and understanding why that has not dropped as we had hoped, we have found that we want to expand that cable measuring program to include all of our train control safety cables and other cables we have wayside, such as our switch heaters and our ETS phones. Emergency trip system phones.
Okay.
So there are numerous other cables we would like to measure.
Okay. And, clearly fires, which get a lot of attention because, they're quite scary and quite visible at, a lot of the track defect issues, never really seen by a riding public unless there's derailment. And we're clearly not where we want to be, and it seems consistent with the data that you provided on where we are in percent of completion on those PM priorities. So can you give us a sense of just roughly when you expect we'll get to a place where we are substantially complete on those areas, just so I can have a timeline horizon?
We continue to progress many of these programs. Cable measuring and straight current testing, we're now, as of yesterday, inching towards 35%. What we want to do is complete this first pass and understand what our failure rate has been. We have started in the worst areas first. We went after the traction power rooms that had the highest level of water infiltration, that had buildup of dirt and debris that were our oldest. So if we see the failure rate of these tests come down to a more manageable level, we would revisit the frequencies and understand if we could stretch them out. A lot of what we are doing now is trying to institutionalize reliability-centered maintenance. So getting to preventive maintenance was the first step. Then we would like to grow to predictive. What technology and inspection tests can we do that will help us predict failures so that we are always balancing the best use of our resources?
So for us, in terms of thinking about it as board members, until we really substantially complete this sort of first pass through all of this, we won't really have, you won't have the data to make recommendations about what an ongoing sort of permanent mature PM program looks like. We're just not there yet.
Correct.
Thank you. Right. If I could, Mr. Dorsey, as you recall, when we started this program, we did not put up an end date on it because we didn't know what we had. And we're still evolving that. We get smarter in some parts of it. We're finding things we didn't expect, and we had to deal with those, as Lara just mentioned, with some of the cabling issues. But I can tell you that over time, as we get this under control, that we can get that tighter and tighter. We will work smarter. We will have it at a condition where we don't have to get into the depth that we're getting into. So, you know, I think there's definitely light at the end of the tunnel. But I do also feel that we're not there yet. And that's why we had proposed that we look at this, you know, for some more time as we get this under greater control. But it is our goal to, you know, provide service as many hours as we possibly can, as long as we're safe and reliable. So that's, you know, that's our goal as well as yours, I believe.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, I just say for me as a slight editorial comment, the on-time performance data is remarkable, but, you know, to me equally remarkable is that customer satisfaction has gone up accordingly. One of, I think, the concerns we always had was would our customers sort of respond to the changes that were made and the improvements that we're seeing. And watching those work hand in hand just validates the whole perspective of safety trumping service, in a sense that it satisfies our customers to see that we're delivering a safe system because it produces reliability.
Very good.
Soapbox.
Very good. Thank you very much. Mr. Evans, did you have a comment?
Well, I was waiting for you.
Okay.
Well, I was going to go after you, but I'll be going before you.
Why don't you go ahead and I'll do the tasking at the. See, then we'll also give other members an opportunity, board members an opportunity.
Yes. So, I do want to make one comment. Someone posted on Twitter that I wasn't paying attention because I had my phone, and actually I have Diligent on my phone. And so I went over to a reporter to point out that I'm actually following on my phone and not paying attention. And they also pointed out that my colleague, Mr. Price, is not here, but he's also not a member of the committee. And I only bring it up, the attempt to make the two district board members look irresponsible was ridiculous. And so I don't appreciate that, and that's why I corrected the reporter for making such an observation that was not accurate. So, again, you know, the world we live in. The big discussion here is about late night hours. And so we're kind of dancing around that a little bit. So I want everybody to understand where the District of Columbia is coming about from. The history a little bit about this is that what this agency was suffering from when most of us came on the board is a lack of track time, a lack of an opportunity to work on the system when no trains are running. And the amount of track time back in 2015 just wasn't enough to get the system fixed. I made a name for myself, for lack of a better way of describing it, with Paul one day at a conference back in the beginning by suggesting we close the blue line for a year, the entire line, and fix it. People in the region reacted very negatively to that, to say the least. Made headlines in the paper, actually. Had we done that, we'd be done with the blue line by now. But nonetheless, the idea of closing an entire line, which other systems have done, was not acceptable. The issue other systems have, though, is many of them are not two-track systems. They're three- or four-track systems. And so they can close lines and continue to operate their trains. We, unfortunately, were built with that fundamental flaw of being a two-track system and consequently have to close down for periods of time to repair the system. When we decided to go to the truncated hours at late night 2 years ago, a little less than 2 years ago now, the district was very concerned about that, and I am as well. I represent an area in the District of Columbia, Ward 2, that is home to over half of the ABC licenses and 70% of the hotel rooms. And so any curtailing of hours at late night dramatically affect the people who live and work in my ward. And I know other people, Kristen, you as well, have an enormous amount of late night activity where you represent, and others do as well. So reluctantly, the District of Columbia went along with the idea of having shorter hours, but with the provision that it would sunset after 2 years, which is what it will do on June 30th. So that brings us to where we are today. The sunset is coming up on June 30th, and where is the District of Columbia? Well, the District of Columbia, starting with the mayor, chairman of the council, myself, and others, feel very strongly that we would like the hours to sunset and go back to the extended hours, which are on the weekends, especially 3 o'clock, Friday and Saturday, go open till 3 o'clock. And the reasons are several-fold. Certainly, people who frequent our bars and restaurants, et cetera, and hotels, we want them to be able to get home. But more importantly, and I've said it back then and I say it now because it's been even more reinforced, people who work in these establishments, the people who are cleaning them afterwards or running them as 3 o'clock in the morning approaches and they're getting off work have no way of getting home. So the idea of Uber and Lyft is not a good idea because many people can't afford it. We run extra bus service, which is great, but as was pointed out in an earlier discussion, people sometimes are not comfortable staying outside at bus stops waiting for a bus to come by, whether it's the weather, whether it's just a fear of safety, whatever, the perception of being unsafe, and they want to ride the trains. And so that's why in the district, at least, we feel very strongly about returning the hours. We also recognize, and I certainly do, the need for track time. So what the general manager is going to do is to look and see what other times could we provide that track time that would take place and replace the late night hours. It's almost similar to a discussion we had over 2 years ago as to what brought us to where we are today. And so I'm looking forward to that, and please, the general manager is willing to take on that project, figure out if there's a time when we can close down the system and get that track time. We did it during the middle of the day sometimes, which is very inconvenient for people, but recognizing no matter when we do it, it's going to be inconvenient for people. The idea of closing down whole segments of lines, which we do now for a period of time of weeks, actually is the most productive way of doing this because the setup and takedown during the evening hours and on weekends, I believe it takes an hour to set up, an hour to take down, so there's all a loss of time because of the setup and takedown, which you wouldn't have if you closed down whole segments of lines. But again, closing down whole segments of lines is an enormous inconvenience for people, and I recognize that as well. There's no easy solution here. All of us have inherited a structure that was neglected for 15 years. From the time I left the board in 2000 till the time I came back in 2015, the maintenance work that should have been done wasn't done. And so that's why we are where we are today, and we have a responsibility to fix it. And that's what we want to do. So to the questions about the FTA, et cetera, certainly in the district, we don't want to do anything that jeopardizes our funding or any of the other support that we get from the FTA or our new safety commission, which is why we would not support an idea of just reducing hours without replacing them with something else. So that kind of gives you a perspective where we are in the district, but I do want to say the District of Columbia feels very strongly about this issue. This is not just me giving my opinion. This is the mayor, the chair, a number of members of the council. And to add to that, I just received a letter today. It's actually addressed to the general manager, and it's signed by virtually every elected official in Montgomery County and Prince George's County, and states, in essence, that they support the district's position of returning the late-night hours. And so anyone who's not familiar with this, this is a letter from every elected official in Prince George's and Montgomery County supporting the same position the District of Columbia has. So that's where we are, and I suspect in 30 days or so we'll be back again to talk about this issue. Thank you.
Let me, Mr. Dorsey, I'm going to make a closing comment on this and with the tasking, but I wanted to give other members an opportunity. Did you want to make a comment?
Just quickly, yes, if I could, Mr. Chair. So, you know, I appreciate Chairman Evans giving the full breadth of where the district is on this. And, you know, this is one of those interesting issues where I think you cited the officials in Prince George's and Montgomery County. I think if you were to ask everybody, would you like to have late night hours, we'd all say yes.
Absolutely.
So I don't think there's any daylight as to the place where we all want to be. The question becomes, how do we balance that with the necessary conditions of the system, which, all due respect to those officials who weighed in with a letter, it's our responsibility to know of Metro's needs and to make those decisions about what's properly balanced. And, you know, I appreciate your comment about the most efficient way to go about dealing with issues. As Mr. Crawford mentioned, we got a chance to see one of those surges in effect. Yeah. It's quite efficient. Yeah. It's a great way to get a lot of work done. It's a wonderful way to think about system renewal, but preventive maintenance is a different bird. And we're not yet at the point where we've matured our preventive maintenance program. Remember, we didn't have one before. So we don't know yet enough what we need to do on an ongoing basis to present the system renewal surge activities that we experience with SafeTrack. By moving prematurely to not have a preventive maintenance program fully mature, and we get into the business of only addressing things through surges, then really what we're wrestling with is a series of repeating SafeTrack light events throughout the course of Metro's operations. And I just don't think that's responsible. I think all of the constituents or the voices who have voiced a desire to go to late night hours would hate that alternative more than having hours limited as they are, at least for a while longer. But I'll just leave it at that.
Mr. McMillan?
Thank you. I got to say, I'm disappointed that we're taking the proposal to extend current hours off the table. I think if the goal is to get to a comparable amount of track time, then the right approach is not to get rid of the track time and then see if we can come up with the alternative, but to keep that track time in place until a better alternative can be found. I assume late night suspension versus midday suspension was chosen for a reason back in the day, and I'm looking at ridership forecast that was prepared back in August, and I won't say I understand all the statistical nuances here, but it appears from the numbers that midday ridership is at least one, perhaps two orders of magnitude higher than late night ridership. And so if we're looking at midday as an alternative to late night for getting track time, it appears to me that we would be inconveniencing, you know, tens if not hundreds more people than we would keep in the current system we have in place.
You are correct. And,
thank you.
The other thing I would add is you'll be taking a deeper cut in your OTP because we can't take out that track time and separate it and look at OTP. So any type of disruption during in service, whether it's early out at night, goes against our OTP. So a midday, we went to middays, you're going to see the OTP in the system drop.
Thank you. And just comment on this presentation. It's very rare in this type of work you see a more convincing presentation of cause and effect. Public administration is not a perfect science, but it's so clear from these numbers what the right solution is, and I hope we eventually get there. If we don't, this area is going to have a transit system that is less reliable, less safe, less efficient, and I'm guessing less robustly funded than we were able to achieve over this past year. Thank you.
Well, at the same time, I would want to put forward to acknowledge the bona fide concerns of the chairman as a steward of this system who's charged with delivering mobility to all people in the footprint of service here, including members of his district. So I hope that in the weeks to come, if not days, we can devise a temporary solution, perhaps in partnership with ride-hailing companies or the like.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to align myself as a member from Maryland with the views you've expressed and have been expressed by Mr. Dorsey and the gentleman from the federal government, Mr. McMillan and Mr. Horner, that safety and reliability of the system from Maryland's standpoint is the highest priority. And so we've supported the current preventive maintenance program from its inception, and we will continue to do so. And as a former chair of the safety committee, I know how important these things are, and I believe firmly that you're doing a great job on this preventive maintenance program, And if we need a have a continued early closing hours during the day and the weekends, this is the trade-off that we have to prevail with and continue with until we're comfortable that the safety and reliability of the system is assured. Having said that, I do want to turn to a separate issue having to do with actually this chart that's in front of you. And under track defects, I noticed that you don't seem to have anything there that addresses the issue of cracked rails. And since we had a cracked rail incident this week, I guess on the rail line between Rosalind and Foggy Bottom, and caused a good deal of disruption, at least from what I saw in the reports. Hopefully that's not another one. It's something that causes me some great concern, because my recollection is we had another cracked rail incident within the last year. And so I'm wondering at this point whether there's a need to expand the preventive maintenance program in some way to address this issue of cracked rails, because while so far we've avoided a real tragedy with a cracked rail in these two incidents, I'm concerned that this is something that we need to pay a little more attention to. And while I understand from Joe and Pat, when we talked about it last year, that it's very difficult to get at some kind of program that addresses that issue, it seems to me that if we have some further thinking about that, and we can bring some kind of cracked rail component into our preventive maintenance system, we may be preventing what potentially could be a big tragedy down the line.
So to answer the question, we take those very seriously, which we assured you of last year. So for the incident you're talking about at Rosalind, we started looking at some of the statistics, and I'll go into what we did specifically at Rosalind. So following the derailment that occurred last January, we increased the frequency of the track ultrasonic testing. So we're actually running more testing and getting less hits, which is showing that the frequency and severity of broken rails is actually going down. I spoke with Laura. We're doing a complete trend analysis to identify where they are, what they are, the types they are. And to some of the things we implemented to reduce the frequency of the broken rails is we revisited all the thermite welding programs. We have our mechanics getting recertified on it. In addition to that, which kind of ties into the preventive maintenance program, is a lot of times your broken rail is actually manifested due to water intrusion. So a lot of the things like the curtain grouting on the red line, all of those things where you remove water from the system cuts down on base corrosion and the root causes of broken rails. So although not presented here, there are a lot of activities going on to address that.
But this one was not on a red line, so I guess maybe is it in the tunnel because it's sort of lower down underwater, that the water table is a little higher in that section between Foggy Bottom and Rosalind?
No, it's actually, there was actually a water leak in that location. It was repaired. There's still minor leaking. The rail had been replaced before that, and then this was a secondary effect, so we're still digging into that one deeper. But it is manifested due to water intrusion.
Thanks. I appreciate that, but I urge you to keep that as a priority that to look at in the preventive maintenance program.
Yeah, we do. And I did want to just add, so we have, with our track bed cleaning, we are more proactively addressing leak mitigation across all lines. That was part of the rationale of expanding it from just the red line to all underground tracks. As Pat touched on, our joint elimination program is strengthening our rail by going back to continuously welded rail. And we do have a rail grinding program, which is something else that we think will address this. It was a program we had been doing before, but perhaps not as consistently as we would like. It's one of the things we were looking at expanding. It just was not part of this original briefing. But there are many other preventive maintenance programs that we do on a nightly basis that did not make this briefing. These were just the ones selected due to the highest either severity of incidents or frequency.
Very good.
Thank you.
Let me go to Mr. Cork.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say,
please,
I will be speaking with the Montgomery County representatives you referenced and explaining to them that they may have misunderstood the alternatives available, and that I'm sure they will conclude at the end of that probably they would agree with me that safety and reliability of the system should be the top priority.
Very good. Mr. Corwin.
Thank you, Clarence, and thank you for leading a great meeting and being open to possibilities for finding other solutions to getting more track repair hours out there. And as I think as others have said, management has done a great job in making great strides to improve the safety of our system, and we can't take our eye off of that ball. And I think we all have to have the goal of getting back to extended hours. I don't think anybody questions that.
Absolutely.
However, the timing is, may not be right today.
Right.
And so let's get there correctly in the long term, and let's make this system safe for everybody that rides it.
Great. Thank you. What I would like to do,
when we're done with the discussion.
What I would like to do at this point would be to ask management to come back with some options, ways that we can find additional track time, maintenance time, so that we can look at that. And if you, do you believe this is something you could do in the next month or so, next 30 days or so?
We will.
Okay, so what we'd like to do then at this point is we've talked about the importance of safety. I support my colleagues from the District of Columbia in terms of wanting to get back to expanded hours as quickly as possible. I think it's, from my standpoint, it's more a matter of timing as to when we can do it. But let's look at some options for maybe alternatives. We may find ourselves in the same boat, and then we'll just have to make us some decisions and make some votes in about 30 days. But let's look at some options and see if there's some things that we can do that would make sense, that would allow us to continue to demonstrate our commitment and priority for having a safe and reliable system.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just to clarify. From our perspective, we will not change, obviously, the maintenance program, the preventive maintenance program. We're still going to perform all the work that we're doing today.
Yes.
We're going to see if we can do other things to do it more efficiently. Are there other windows of times that we could use? But I would also suggest that we also look, are there other alternatives for meeting the demand side of it, particularly in the late night hour issue? So it's not just that we're looking at the track time, but the demand that's on the system. Is there other ways of meeting that demand that we should explore?
Excellent. Agree. Thank you. Okay. I guess...
Are we done with the discussion of preventive maintenance and track time?
Yes. We're getting ready to move to the second item, but...
Carry on. No, I'll just reserve my question for the end.
All righty. Ms. Mace, if you would walk us through summer of... I guess, is it your team?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. The summer of 2019. And as you walk through that, if you can highlight lessons learned from other closures and things that are working that we're going to try and to do to continue to improve our performance during those times. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Morning.
Today's presentation, we're going to cover next summer's station platform project that will close six stations and impact about 8% of our weekday riders. Regina Sullivan and I will cover the draft mitigation plans that we've been working on, ongoing coordination with the local jurisdictions, and we're going to have Lynn Bowersock to cover the highlights of the customer retentive initiatives that we've learned from our past.
Is your microphone? Okay.
Can you hear me?
Better.
Sorry. Okay, next slide. Based on our lessons that we've learned from a safe track operation and this past summer's shutdowns, we have developed some guidelines to help minimize the impact on our customers. On an annual basis, our track department, we identify all the maintenance activities that need to be programmed during the upcoming year and to develop a maintenance schedule that accomplish those programs while minimizing this disruption to our customers. We do this by combining a various work efforts into consolidated shutdowns instead of a series of small outages. This allows us to provide the best possible service outside the area where we're doing the construction. It also It also gives us the ability to develop a plan ahead of time, schedule ahead of time, gives us the ability to provide public notice in advance, and allows us time to prepare for our outages. We're here today, we're reviewing the major disruptions that is planned for the upcoming summer. In May this year, we told the committee about the upcoming platform rehab project and its significant impact that will occur this summer. Between Memorial Day and Labor Day, there will be a 101-day shutdown on the portion of Blue and Yellow Line south of National Airport. Six stations will be closed. Braddock Road, King Street, Eisenhower, Huntington, Van Dorn, and Franconia Springfield stations. National Airport will remain open and will be the southern terminus for both the Blue and the Yellow Lines. Because of the overall scope of the platform program, the reconstruction of Van Dorn Station is tentatively scheduled for a four-week period in September, between September 3rd and September 29th. This effort will require us to do single-track operation on a blue line between King Street and Franconia Springfield and reduce the service line on a blue line during that portion. The yellow line will have been restored to normal service. It may be possible to complete the Van Dorn platform work in the larger summer program, as the contract that we've let for the platform program has been structured to include incentives for the contractor to complete that. That's a possibility. We won't know for sure until this summer when the work starts whether or not he's going to be able to complete it. We're going to need the single track in September. Virginia's good.
Thanks, Jim. We've also used the lessons from the Safe Track experience and other recent shutdowns to put together a group of stakeholders to provide our riders with as many options as possible during the shutdown. This group includes representatives from local government, our congressional delegation, federal government, transit providers, police and emergency management, and very importantly, the Metropolitan Washington Airport Authority. We also have private sector participants. For example, American Airlines is one of our members of our stakeholder group. This effort began last August with a meeting here at Metro with representatives from all of the stakeholders to educate everyone on our plans for next summer. Our goal is to put together, as Jim said, a coordinated plan to provide options for our riders. That work continues right now with monthly conference calls to coordinate, and we will begin bi-monthly calls after the new year as we get closer to the shutdown. We are also going to reach out to the representatives of the RAC and the ACC to ask them to begin to participate in this group to help get input from them. As we get closer to the shutdown, we're going to do a more regional coordination with Maryland and the District of Columbia as partners in it, too. I want to take a moment to thank NVTC and all of the jurisdictional staff who've been incredibly supportive of this process and real partners to us. Mr. Hughes is now going to talk about the Metrobus mitigation plans that his team has put in place for the shutdown.
Thank you. Based on the lessons we've learned from past disruptions, we understand that a strong bus replacement component is required. It will provide good connection for the riders, the normally rider system of the closed stations, to connect to the system that's still open. What we've experienced is that a good plan will carry about 60% of the displaced riders. They show up and they get on the buses. For this project, we've worked with the local jurisdictions, as Regina has described, and we've developed this plan that's included in the slide. There will be two free express bus shuttles to the Pentagon, one from Franconia and Springfield and one from Huntington Stations. There are the dark blue lines on the slide. There will also be two free local shuttles connecting all the closed stations in the Pentagon and the National Airport. Those are the light blue lines on the map. We've also learned from our past experience, people migrate to other services, bus services in the area. So Metro is planning on adding capacity to five of the existing routes. They're described in the slide, and they're shown in red. We're now working with the local jurisdictions and the contractors in the area to figure out how we serve the riders with bus stops, with local mitigation to get them around kiss and ride areas, because each of those five stations will be disrupted from the contractors. Some of them are staging areas where the work that they're doing. So that's the next step of what we're doing to figure out how specifically those shuttles will work.
As Jim just described, the Metrobus plan that he has put in place, there's some, this slide will provide some of the local, some of the work that's being done by our local partners, the Fairfax Connector, Alexandria Dash, and OmniRide, and Arlington too. This is the works thus far that they have committed, the options thus far that they have committed to providing during the shutdown. These are additive to the Metrobus plan that Mr. Hughes just described. Next slide. Okay, thanks. We're also working with our regional partners on other options for because we know that bus ridership, both on Metrobus and even the work that's being done with our jurisdictional partners, won't be enough. These include park and ride locations, telework policies, and specifically we're working not just with OPM, but also with the local governments and private sector employers to provide telework options during that period. We're trying to put in place, it's difficult but quickly, some signal prioritization and some dedicated, additional dedicated lanes specifically on 395. We've had outreach to the slugging community to help us with provide additional rides, and we're coordinating with the transportation demand management professionals in the region, which has been very helpful. We've made progress, and we'll continue to work on these options, but we need commitments from the state and local jurisdictions in place by the end of January to stay on track with our commitment to provide a complete plan and communicate it to our riders by next spring. So we will continue to, and we'll be happy to provide updates as we go through that process. I'm going to turn to Lynn now to address our customer retention efforts.
Thanks, Regina. So the final portion, and I'm batting cleanup here in this presentation, of course, is with all of these rich mitigation plans in place with our partners, what do our customers know and when do they need to know it? We learned a great deal last summer from the Red Line shutdown. We, our quality assurance team and our research team reached out to those customers both before and after the outage to find out what we could do better going forward in future opportunities. And so here we see that while general awareness of the Red Line outage was quite high, customers told us that they wanted more details on the alternative transportation options and that they need to better understand why a shutdown is required in the first place. We also learned that people who telework only during the shutdown rebound very quickly back to the system. So that was an important learning for us because we were quite concerned that telework would be an attractive option, that they would stay home to work and not come back to the system. But those who are just temporarily teleworking are coming back quickly. So we will encourage to, we will continue to encourage temporary telework among employers. We also learned as a result of that assessment on the Red Line that customers want us to create better and longer lasting signs on the system. It's not enough to have them up for a couple of days. They need them over time to be reminded again and again of what's coming. They want us to give them realistic expectations about travel times on the shuttle. So you can imagine if you take a train every day, you kind of know what the travel time is that you spend on that train. But once you go above ground and you get on a bus, it's a free alternative to the train. You expect to get there. My commute every day on the Red Line takes 39 minutes. But I wouldn't think until I did it that a bus alternative on that same commute would be much longer than 39 minutes because of traffic. So they want to know up front, you know, how much more time should I plan in my day to get to the same destination. They also want us to give alternative stations to use outside the work zone. So if I can't take the train from A to B, is there someplace else in the system that I could get on and still reach my destinations through some other route that I'm not familiar with? Please give me that kind of advice. And improvements to the shuttle services themselves. They asked us for better support for customers who use mobility devices and to make sure that our driver scheduling is optimized for that shuttle route. So we're looking at all of those pieces of feedback to improve the alternative services that we offer. We've also started to reach out to our customers in Northern Virginia to say, what do you want to know specifically with respect to these outages and when do you want to know it? We have had a very high level of participation participation from customers. When you take a survey, you typically get a single-digit response. We're at 10% in the very first wave of research that we did. We learned, in the next slide, you'll see that already awareness is quite high that something is going to happen. I think that our partners have been a real help, as has the media, in making sure that that information is out there. But it's, of course, too soon for riders to begin travel planning for next summer. They basically said, if you look, about 56% say anywhere between 2 weeks and 2 months ahead of a disruption is when they're going to focus and try to decide what their alternative transportation plan is. So we have time to finalize the mitigation plan, give them those options, and get them to make informed decisions. Interestingly, when we asked them on the red line what their preferred channels were for getting information about this, the actual ways that they learned that they reported afterwards didn't align with those preferred channels. So people say, you know, this is what I think I want. Then they say how they've got that information, and sometimes those two things disconnect. So the actual sources of awareness, unlike the chart that you see where they said email or text message was most preferred, word of mouth was number one. Almost always is, but people never would offer that up front. Brochures distributed at stations was number two. Posters in stations and on trains, number three. And newspapers online or in print, number four. So we're going to do it all. We're going to do all of that, and we're going to go back with a richer email and text program in Northern Virginia and try to cover all of those channels well. We also learned, and this has come through in the research in both places, that our customers who ride rail exclusively are not familiar with the regular route system, right? So if you look at this, I can tell you that when we talked to the Yellow and Blue Line customers, 67% were unfamiliar with Metroway, 77% didn't know that the 8Z ran that route, and similar numbers for the 10A, the 11Y, and the 21A. So all of these buses are out there already, and they offer service for some of those folks that would be helpful, but they're not aware of them. So we need to do an education process about how to ride the bus, where to catch the bus, where the bus leaves you, and so forth. As a result of that lack of information, when you see on the next slide, when you ask people today without knowing anything else, what would you do? Most of them say, I'm going to take that free shuttle bus that just picks me up at the rail station. That's their default position. So we have a job to do if we want to spread that travel out across multiple modes. So there will be a board policy matter that comes back to you at some point. As Regina said, we're looking at customer retention strategies, and that basically means, are there premiums or incentives that we can offer our customers to welcome them back to rail once this disruption is over? And so part of our research is to say what makes a difference to you, and if that is a discount or incentive on a future Smart Trip card, we'll be back to the board to authorize that. The next steps for us, we recently issued, we awarded the contract for the platform work, and thanks to my colleagues for the work that they did on that. As we now finalize and refine the schedule with the contractor in place, we'll be able to finalize the travel alternatives that we're working with our stakeholders on. We'll complete the evaluation and promotion incentive strategies and return to the board for approval on that, and begin in the early spring time frame to notify our customers and educate them on their travel options. Any questions?
Thank you very much. We really appreciate that, and appreciate the lessons learned, incorporating lessons learned to try to figure out how we can minimize the impact and things that we can do to encourage our customers to come back. Let me now first open up for a round of brief questions from any questions from members of our committee. Comments, questions? Mr. Dorsey?
Quick comment, question. I know we're stressed for time. This is obviously going to be a big deal to a lot of folks, not only just in Virginia, but a significant portion of Metro's ridership. So I appreciate the coordination and implementing the Safe Track sort of lessons learned for proactively coordinating. So this is just encouragement to keep up the good work and make sure it doesn't lapse. But since this is more than just the platforms, you're trying to get a lot of other work done. What's your plan for communicating to the board your success and completion? completing other projects as we try and, you know, sort of balance the efficiency of all of the surges and preventive maintenance? What are we likely to hear reported back from this?
Sure. As Lynn mentioned, one of the things we want to improve upon is communicating out the purpose for the shutdown, why it's needed. We've stressed up the platforms, but as you alluded to, there's a lot of other work we will do in that area. As we get closer to the event, we will share our finalized scope, what we plan to get done in that shutdown, and we'll issue periodic reports. I believe under SafeTrack, we landed on between biweekly and monthly. This is going to be our longest event, so we'll reach out to our customers to understand the frequency with which they want those updates. There will definitely be a final report afterwards that shares the successes, what we accomplished, any challenges we experienced, and confirm that we completed what we intended to do.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Any other members of our committee comments?
No, I'll just stop.
Okay. Nope. Okay. Open it up to other members more broadly.
Yep. I'd like to ask a question of management for the record. I want to preface the question by noting that our general manager often says that he has the most interesting, best job in the world. And when he says that, he also graciously omits from saying that it's also the hardest or one of the hardest jobs in the world. So I want to acknowledge it's a hard job and ask the question in that spirit. But my question to you pertains to 21st century safety, really. I noted in the presentation made by one of your colleagues that one of the enterprise risks of WMATA is cybersecurity and inappropriate access to the system. So as you're aware, the agency has underway a procurement for the 8,000 series rolling stock rail car fleet. I wanted to ask you what steps management is taking to ensure that the award of the contract for the 8,000 series rail car will not create a platform for the conduct of cyber espionage in the nation's capital by non-allied governments of the United States?
A simple one. This is an issue, obviously, that is, it's an industry issue. It's not just here, and that's one of the things. So we're working as an industry trying to get our arms around this. We actually have recently hired someone with an FBI background in cybersecurity, who you'll be meeting later in the day, to basically that person's focus, and not only in just this particular contract, but overall. Again, because as you know, as we think into the future, you know, and as this is changing so quickly, that we have to create a program that, you know, 10 years ago we probably would never thought of having. So we're just building that. So it's a combination of taking what other people have done as an industry, how we're attacking this, and creating the resources internally that we actually have this as a ongoing function, that it's not just something that's part of an IT department somewhere, but actually someone that gets up every morning and that's what they think about and work about. So we're just at the beginning of that. For sure, but one thing that we have asked this gentleman that just joined us is to take a look at that particular RFP and sort of scrub that for these types of issues.
Right. Well, I would thank you for that. In my mind, while it's a technical problem, it is also a challenge for procurement, specifically to ensure that the criteria for award of the contract take into account the risk that I described, and that we don't want to be in a position in which we are obliged to award a contract under the terms of the RFP without regard to the risk that I described.
Very good. Very good point. Okay, well, at this point here, thank everyone for participating. I would like to adjourn our committee so that we can then move to the Finance Committee. Thank you very much, everyone.